the enemies or the other side that unfortunately would bring up the fights, and he had to defend the Muslim Ummah from these darknesses and these wrongdoings. We pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that He always keeps us on the right track. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program Gate of Knowledge on Iran Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
بالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من نداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد ممجد والفضل يمنى هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Welcome, dear listeners, to another day on Iran Radio, broadcasting from the heart of Tehran. I invite you to settle in as we bring you a thoughtful blend of voices, views, and stories that matter. Our next program is Spotlight, your daily lens on the most crucial events happening in the world today. Join us for roundtable analysis and discussion of topical and sometimes controversial issues with two expert guests providing their sharp insights. Next up, we'll diving into a collection of our finest radio productions. Following that, Member brings the pulpit's wisdom to life. In Member, we feature selected excerpts from the speeches of well-known Islamic scholars covering a wide range of topics, including ethics, theology, Quranic interpretation, Islamic history, and sometimes even social and political issues. Member brings timeless words that inspire thought, faith, and action. Up next is Spotlight. Please stay with us.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome, everyone. The Hezbollah leader Sheikh Naim Qassem has said the Lebanese resistance movement will not surrender or lay down its weapons in response to Israeli threats despite mounting pressure to disarm. The Lebanese authorities, under pressure from the Zionist regime and Western governments, most notably the U.S. and France, have called on the resistance group to disarm and lay down its arms. Now, this, as many today attribute the integrity of Lebanon's sovereignty to Hezbollah's arms, its determination and protection of Lebanese soil. It was Hezbollah that put an end to Israel's occupation of Lebanon and kept the country whole for the past few decades. And Sheikh Qassem says, quote, "We will continue to defend because we believe liberation is our duty." This and more of the Sheikh's statements and positions outlined during his speech and interview is what we'll cover in today's Spotlight program. And now for our guests. Joining us in the Hatoum, editor-in-chief at Mena Uncensored for Lebanese capital, Beirut. And also also Mr. Mohsen Saleh, academic and political commentator, also joining us from the Lebanese capital. Hello, and I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. I guess we will do the gentlemanly thing and start with you, Ms. Leila Hatoum. Hezbollah argues that Lebanese politicians have opted, Leila, for silence towards repeated aggression by the Zionist regime on Lebanese territory since the infamous late November 27th ceasefire's implementation, including assassinations and occupation. Your initial take on options that Beirut has to defend itself?
Well, you have to understand one thing. When it comes to Lebanon, we have nothing to lose at the moment. And as resistance, basically, so long that you have an occupation, the resistance doesn't have to listen to the dictations of neither the Lebanese government nor the international community. International law gives it the right to move freely in terms of fighting that occupation. At the end of the day, there is mounting pressure on Lebanon, not only by the Americans and the Israelis and basically their allies across the world. I call them the axis of evil. But also from internally, the internal front in Lebanon is divided, severely polarized when it comes to politics and positions. Some of them, they support the West, and they are funded by the West and the GCC countries, among other Arab nations who are anti-Hezbollah, and somehow like they have animosity against Iran. So at the end of the day, all this basically surmounting pressure that we call tells Hezbollah that they have no allies around in terms of this particular region, and they have to fend for themselves. And that's why basically we saw Sheikh Naim Qasim actually commenting on that matter, saying that so long that there's an aggression, we will not back off from resisting. Nobody can force us to do so, and we will continue to fight, but according to our own time, and we will respond in the manner that we see fit.
Thank you there, Leila. And Mr. Mohsen Saleh, welcome to the program. Sir, now, Mr. Saleh, I'm going to put the same question to Sheikh Qasim. In response to nearly 4,000 ceasefire violations by the occupation since late November, and the occupation also of five strategic hilltops there in southern Lebanon, said what Israel is not is committed to is implementing the first stage of the agreement, that is withdrawing, stopping its aggression and reconnaissance flights, releasing the prisoners, and starting reconstruction. He said, as much as we are concerned, the equation that America and Israel want to impose, namely either kill or surrender, is not acceptable. What is important to us is our rights. We are ready to be martyred or to win, and we are ready for both choices. Now, Mr. Mohsen Saleh, many people feel this should be the exact position of the Aoun government as well.
Well, good evening to you and to your guests and to the crew and to the audiences. I guess it's about time, as Sheikh Naim, the Secretary General, said, it's about time for people to understand that the resistance attitude from this paper of Brack, Thomas Brack, and the Republic, or the Lebanese Republic, or the presidents, the three presidents, the Prime Minister and the Speaker, and also the President Aoun, I guess they have some kind of asking the same questions of Hezbollah and the resistance. First of all, the Israelis have not been committed to the resolution 1701. They continued their war against the Lebanese territories and the Lebanese people in the south, on the borders and otherwise, in reaching to Tripoli, killing people, assassinating people, preventing the Lebanese government from spreading or putting its authority in the south. So I guess we are close to the kind of national unity about the issue of the arms. While the Americans and the Westerns, they are threatening the Lebanese government and the people, the Lebanese people, and of course Hezbollah, they are threatening them of the Israeli attack on Lebanon, initiating another war. That's the point, I guess. Now Hezbollah is ready for all the possibilities in terms of confronting and combating on the ground whenever the Israelis want to initiate a war, to also go into the deep borders of Lebanon, and also reaching to Syria. That's what they are threatening. I guess it's about time for the for the international community and the people of the Lebanese government as well to understand that the resistance was not defeated during the talks to arrange the ceasefire. The Israelis were defeated on the ground, in the battlefield. They have shouted and yelled and talked to the Americans, asked them urgently to stop the fire and issue a momentum to stop the fire in the south. That's why the Lebanese government is really trying to understand the resistance position from this situation, while the Americans are always putting the ground for facilitating the way for the Israelis in order to be to have the hegemony in the south and in Lebanon, preparing for the new Middle East, as Netanyahu said, and preparing also for naturalization with Lebanon. This will not happen. The resistance is still ready and more powerful than the past, and the coming days will show that the resistance having all the power that will retaliate against the aggressions of the Israelis. You have mentioned 4,000 attack or violation against the 1701. I would ask the Israelis always, every day they have violation, every day, not only once, all their drones in the skies of Lebanon, all their warplanes in Lebanon, and on the borders they attack even the people who are going back in order to check their homes and their farms, but they are preventing everything. But it's about time to tell the Israelis to stop, and the Americans to stop the pressure on the Lebanese, because the Lebanese will not be lenient towards these attacks and these violations.
And good points there, Mr. Assad. Thank you. And Leila, your thoughts on why certain powers are demanding Hezbollah disarm. We have to ask, Leila, why? What is Hezbollah doing, or has it done, to warrant laying down its arms? Because one thing Israel has over the decades, proven is that it is a direct threat to Lebanon, its sovereignty and territorial integrity.
Well, if you look at the whole situation from the Israeli aggression on Lebanon and the second invasion in 1978, because they invaded 1978 first, the presence of multiple resistance groups on the ground were kind of effective in harming a little bit the Israelis, but they were never successful in pushing the Israelis out of most of South Lebanon. The only resistance that managed to actually kick out the Israelis from most of South Lebanon and using strategic weapons and strategic training, and their bases and their basically what you call social milieu is growing year on year, time after time, is Hezbollah. So Hezbollah forms what you call danger to the Israeli plan of having greater Israel, of expanding into South Lebanon and most of Lebanon, if not all of Lebanon, later on to greater Israel, as well as it actually invokes hope in people that there is a possibility if you stand in the face of an aggressor, you can actually beat that aggressor. So at the end of the day, the Israelis are trying to eliminate this glitch in the system. The only way they can do so, they know that they cannot eradicate Hezbollah or the resistance in Lebanon, because resistance is an idea. At the end of the day, what they're trying to do is weaken Hezbollah to the extent that they are going to try to disarm it from its strategic weapons and create a toothless tiger out of it. And this is impossible to happen, knowing the Lebanese and knowing their mentality and knowing how they basically stick to their land and they fight back. They are some of the strongest fighters in the region. So because they pose threat to the Israeli entity and its plan for the region to have greater Israel, and the European and Western plan in general to continue to have this parasitic entity among us and subdue and subjugate the rest of the populations in our region, that's the reason why they're going after Hezbollah and the resistance in Lebanon.
The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines. featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you. And Mr. Saleh, also elsewhere in Sheikh Qasim's remarks, he roundly rejected for the movement to lay down its arms. He said there is no third option between victory and martyrdom. We do not have surrender as an option. So Hezbollah's position, it is and it has been simple, cut and dry. How do you see things playing out? Hezbollah maintains this position moving forward. The pressure persists from the U.S. and its allies and the Zionist entity. Where does it end, or do we reach an impasse, or how do you see this thing unfolding in the future?
Well, in the manner of the Israeli natural instinct towards Lebanon and towards the Palestinians and towards all the Arabs and even the human beings, in confronting such instincts, I guess the resistance in Lebanon, they have no choice, no option but to continue in struggling against these criminals who committed all the crimes in the modern history in Gaza and in Lebanon and anywhere in the places wherever they go, to Yemen, to Iran, of course. What would you do but to tackle and grip your hand on the arms you have and the courage you have and the belief of not only victory, but you have to defend by blood and by the arms. It's these real things, as I said in the beginning, that the resistance was not defeated on the ground. They have implanted their bodies and their blood on the borders and prevented the Israelis from going into the Lebanese villages and cities in Khiyam and Naqoura and Ayd al-Shaab and other places. So I would say Sheikh Naim, the Secretary General, is reaching the point that the resistance, the freedom fighters in the South, they are saying that they are ready to continue the battle against this enemy who will not stop but by the resistance. The resistance, the only way, the only path in order to stop this enemy from putting an end to its aggression. And the Americans and the Lebanese government, they understand that. That's why Barak said he won't guarantee any Israeli aggression. He knows, and the Europeans know that they cannot stop the Israelis. The only thing that might stop the Israelis is the resistance. That's why Sheikh Naim said either martyrdom or victory. There is no other choice. As you said, is there any other choice, any other option in confronting the Israelis? The problem is that either they have the hegemony and the upper hand and to enslave others, or to kill them. That's what they have been doing in Gaza and the West Bank. That's what they want to do in Lebanon. But the issue is that the resistance in Lebanon is powerful, strong, and believe in its right in defending its place. The might does not make right. The Israelis have no right in order to invade or to kill or to occupy any parts of Lebanon. That's why the Lebanese government has only one choice, but to come to unity with the resistance in order to protect the sovereignty and the authority. If the government insists on having the monopoly over everything in Lebanon, under the pressure of the American and the French and the Europeans, I guess we are going to a deadlock and not having a solution. That's what the Israelis want. But I would say firmly, with great confidence, that the Israelis cannot go into Lebanon and invade Lebanon, because the resistance is still powerful and have all the integrity and the honor and the decision to fight against the Israelis. And they have tried the resistance in Lebanon, and they could not achieve anything, but by the resolution and the resistance gave a chance, gave some time for the government in order to continue its diplomatic power or relations with the Americans and others. But I would say, with no pessimism, that the resistance has the right, and I am very optimistic that the resistance can achieve what they want, the freedom fighters, the strugglers for freedom in the South Lebanon, exactly in South Lebanon. They can achieve something I guess nobody has achieved, because they achieved, as your guest said, they achieved victory in 2000, where all the Arab governments, they could not achieve anything.
And that's a very good point. I was going to bring that up later as well. Thank you, Mr. Saleh. And Leila, and I'm glad Mr. Saleh made this point, that it seems all the justification points to the pressure being on Tel Aviv and not on Beirut. Because we have to really ask ourselves, we have to highlight, actually, every time that Hezbollah carried out an operation against the occupation, what was it about? It was either to defend against occupation of Lebanon, to defend against some kind of aggression, or in the latest case, to defend against genocide, the wholesale slaughter by the Zionist entity against the Palestinian civilian population in Gaza. It's always been a retaliatory resistance type operation to either defend something, protect something, or push something off of land it does not belong on. All the justification is for Hezbollah to remain intact and for the condemnation to be toward Tel Aviv and not vice versa.
Well, you have to understand that when you are called a resistance, you are a reaction to an original action, that's an occupation. So everything that the resistance does, even if it's attacking the occupation anywhere across the world, by the way, according to international, it has to attack it. It has the right to attack it across the world. It's a retaliation to the original sin, which is the occupation. So having said that, they are covered no matter what. Unfortunately, people look at it from a classical perspective, trying to find justifications to the resistance and trying to basically claim that the pressure is now on Tel Aviv to stop this war, etc. No, this is not the case. When you look at the whole situation, unfortunately, in reality, we live in the real world. Most of the nations across us from this region and beyond are siding with the Israeli entity and trying to pressure resistance movements and those who are supporting the resistance movements to back off and allow the Israeli occupation to have a breather. In that sense, the pressure is on Tel Aviv in terms of the possible danger posed against it by resistance movements in this region, especially from Hezbollah and Lebanon and Amal movement, among other basic resistance movements, but also not only basically from those resistance movements, but also from those supporting them. And in that sense, Tel Aviv is pressuring its allies to go and pressure Lebanon, the Lebanese government, to create a problem for Hezbollah internally and the resistance in Lebanon internally by saying that we have to discuss the matter of your weapons, you have to disarm, and we see politicians within the government and beyond trying to create that pressure. Having said that, you also have to understand another thing. No matter how much they try, under international law, a government has no right, any government, including the local government, has no right to disarm the resistance so long that there's an occupation. And I'll give an example. The Vichy government in France, which used to cooperate with the Nazi occupation of France, used to call the French resistance terrorists. So that's why the international law came about, to support the French resistance. The way I look at it, the resistance in Lebanon at the moment is living what we call a golden chance of actually doing what it needs and what it wants to do without having to look back, because one, everybody around it has taken off their masks, two, international law is on its side, and three, at the same time, they have taken enough time to reassess what happened and to rebuild. And this is what Sheikh Naim Qassem, Hezbollah Secretary General, said in his most recent interview and his past speeches, and to plan what's going to go ahead. When it comes to Tel Aviv, they're afraid because they don't know the new leadership in Hezbollah and the first-tier leadership in terms of battlefields and the ground, but basically commanders. They don't know who they are. They don't know how they think. They don't know how they act. Hezbollah turned back to the situation of the 1980s when you had an Israeli occupation. Syria was against Lebanon at the time, against the resistance. You had a massive disruption in terms of political powers. They were all polarized, some against the resistance, some pro-resistance. So we're back to that situation. The only difference is that the Israelis have been blocked out of spying on Hezbollah in terms of technology because Hezbollah went back to that, what you call, plan of 1980s. Now we see the real deal. The Israelis are going to attack, or they continue to actually breach the resistance's social milieu by killing people every day in South Lebanon. You're going to see a reaction later on. But the resistance doesn't act hormonally. It doesn't act emotionally. They act smartly. So that's why they're patient.
And we don't have much time left, but I really want to get this last question to Mr. Saleh. Mr. Saleh, could you imagine for years, U.S., its European allies in Israel, they've wanted to disarm many of the resistance groups in the region. They wanted to basically anyone that is hostile against the Israeli apartheid occupation entity, Hezbollah. They want Hezbollah's arms. They want Hamas's arms. They want Islamic Jihad's arms. They want to disarm the Ansarullah. They want Iran's missiles, you very well know, for years now. Tell me, if they were successful in putting an end to all the resistance in the region, what would West Asia look like at that point, and how would anyone counter Israel's expansionism?
Well, I would say if that happened, and God forbids this from happening, I guess the gloomy environment would surround the whole countries and the peoples of the region. But I would say no. They have tried to disarm Hezbollah in 1991, in 1993, in 1996, in 2006, and after that also they have tried a lot. And the Americans were backing the Israelis, and they have initiated many wars, and they failed. And at the same time, they failed in 2024 in order to disarm and invade Lebanon. They have failed in their planning and designing the way to disarm Lebanon, disarm the mentality and the intellect of Lebanon, of having this guts in order to continue their combating the Israelis and to confronting the Israelis. Now, I guess Lebanon, after the martyrdom of the master of the martyrs of the community of the Ummah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, well, once he said, well, the Israelis are fighting people who loves Imam Hussein and loves now Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah and Imam Khomeini and the people of having this this spirit of resistance and the spirit of having this freedom in order to continue their march for a new liberty for the region. I would not expect any kind of this kind of defeat. You have mentioned my brother. I won't see any picture like having the Israelis. They have their problems. They have their social and military and problems even in Gaza, in spite of all these massacres all over Gaza. But they have not defeated the Gazans from resisting this occupation. Every day in Beit Hanun, in Khan Yunus, anywhere you will find operation that would brightly done by the these strugglers in Gaza. And I guess the Lebanese resistance is as well as powerful and as well as having the decision and having the spirit of continuing the resistance. I am very optimistic about this. They have planned. They have conspired with all the Americans and the Westerns and some of the Arabs. They pressured the resistance. But I will the returning of the spirit of the resistance in this region from Yemen to Palestine and Lebanon, even in some parts of Syria, even in Iraq, in the West Bank, all these people, they cannot put them down at all.
Thank you both for joining us. Time has gotten the better of us. Appreciate having you both on. Stay safe to the both of you, Leila Hatoum, and also Mr. Mohsen Saleh, both joining us from Beirut. And viewers, this brings us to the end of your Spotlight program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
In the vast sky of Iran's history, certain names shine like brilliant stars, names that through steadfastness and devotion have earned not only victories on the battlefield but a place in the hearts of every Iranian. The commanders of this land from ancient times to today have always stood as symbols of resistance, courage, and sacrifice. Relying on faith, knowledge, and a deep love for their homeland, they have confronted every threat and defended the honor and integrity of this nation. Commander Ghulam Ali Rashid is one of those immortal names, a man whose presence on the battlefield struck fear into the heart of the enemy and whose patriotic zeal served as an unbreakable shield for his country, a time life spent defending Iran and its ideals ultimately culminated in his martyrdom during the Zionist regime's aggression against Iran. His name is now recorded forever in the scroll of this land's glory. Born in 1953 in the city of Desful in the southern province of Khuzestan, Ghulam Ali Rashid stepped onto the path of jihad from an early age. His political activities against the Pahlavi regime reflected the determined will of this remarkable man. Before the victory of the Islamic Revolution, due to his anti-regime actions, he was arrested and transferred to Ahvaz, where he served a 9-year prison sentence. That prison term became a turning point, bringing him into contact with prominent figures such as Mohsen Rezai and Ali Shamkhani, who would later become senior commanders in the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, IRGC. In 1976, he was arrested again in Isfahan and transferred to Tehran, spending yet another year in prison. But even prison walls could not contain his resolve. Upon release, he resumed his struggle with renewed strength on the front lines of truth against tyranny. Following the establishment of the IRGC, Ghulam Ali Rashid began his service as the Deputy for Intelligence and Operations in the Desful IRGC. During the Iraqi Ba'ath regime's imposed war against Iran, he rose to become one of the Iran's senior commanders, playing a pivotal role in many major operations. Beyond his military service, Commander Rashid was also a leader in the realm of knowledge and education. He held a master's degree in political geography from the University of Tehran and a PhD in the same field from Terbiyat Mudarris University. He also served as an associate professor and faculty member at both the Supreme National Defense University and Imam Hussein University, training generations of future defense scholars and officers. Elevated to the rank of Major General, he was appointed Deputy Chief of the General Staff of the Armed Forces, and he also served as Deputy for Defense Affairs at the Secretariat of the Supreme National Security Council. And finally, the proud culmination of this honorable path was the martyrdom that testifies to his ultimate level of loyalty and self-sacrifice. On the morning of Friday, June 13, 2025, Commander Rashid attained martyrdom in a cowardly Israeli missile strike on Tehran, sacrificing his life in defense of the homeland he had so long protected. Throughout decades of service, his record was one of wisdom, leadership, and unmatched bravery. As one of the chief commanders of the Sacred Defense era, he played a vital role in planning and executing major, decisive military operations. His active presence on the front lines and his sensitive role, such as Deputy for Intelligence and Operations in Desful, bear witness to his deep involvement and commitment to defending the country's borders. His ability to coordinate between the Army and IRGC at Khatam al-Anbiya headquarters, the highest operational command structure of Iran's armed forces, was a clear of reflection of his exceptional strategic and managerial capabilities. This distinguished performance made him one of the chief architects of Iran's post-revolutionary defensive power. What doubled the strength of Commander Rashid was not only his military ability, but his insight and intellectual depth. His academic background in political geography and his scientific activities in prestigious institutions gave his military analysis profound richness. He was not merely a battlefield commander, he was a thoughtful strategist who fused theoretical knowledge with experience. This combination of scholarship, experience, and foresight made him a heavyweight figure not only in combat zones, but also in strategy rooms and high-level planning sessions. His presence lent great weight to decisions and operations, making him a model of both power and prudence. In the end, the martyrdom of Commander Rashid is a cowardly act of Israeli aggression, highlighted the peak of his strength and faithfulness to the nation and its ideals. To his final breath, he wore the uniform of service and defense. His life is textbook in resistance, sacrifice, and patriotism. His brilliance and unparalleled courage remain a lasting legacy, a legacy that secures his name an eternal place in the proud history of Iran.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Amin Rastani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We were trying to take inspiration from Ashura and Karbala, Imam Hussein, not to make the same mistake of the people of Kufa that pushed them to the point where they stood in the face of the Imam and the Imam explained why they're making this mistake. And what does the Imam say there? He says, "Mulat butunuhum bil haram," that their bellies have been filled with haram. And this is what we want to speak about tonight, inshallah. I want to share with you some of the hadiths we have. It says every time a person puts into their body a haram morsel, what happens is that the angels send their la'na and curses and damnations upon this person. Right? You know what that means, right? Sometimes we send a la'nat on somebody because we just don't like them. And we feel good after we send la'nat on them. You know, someone does something like lanat on you, man, and then we feel good about ourselves. Okay? But with the angels, it's not like that. It's not like the angels are like, let me feel better, lanat on this person, because they had a haram, they consumed something haram that didn't belong to them. No, the lana of the angels is, oh Allah, deprive this person of your mercy. Look at all these other people trying their best, hustling. Look at all the good stuff you put out there, oh Allah. But this person, for whatever reason, that we'll get to later, we'll talk about a little bit. For whatever reason, this person still chooses to go the haram route. Yeah, sometimes the situation calls, the situation is pretty dire, and it calls for me to do something that's not permissible initially, but now I have no choice. Those are specific cases. But in this day and age especially, yeah, there's a lot of halal out there too. So these angels, they're sending their la'na on this person. And then slowly it affects our ibadah as well. It says that the ibadah of a person, the worship of a person who does haram khari, okay, that eats and consumes haram, what happens to them? It's like they are building a building that whose foundation is on sand. So you need a building for your future. You need a building for your akhirah. We need our houses in the akhirah, guys. Alright? And we need a lot of houses. But a person who is taking in haram, yes, their ibadah is built on a foundation of sand. Yes, another hadith. A couple more and then we'll go move on. A person who has a haram income, it says, Allah does not accept any good deeds from them. Because any good deed they're doing probably is going back to the haram money that they have, right? If it's sadaqah, Allah doesn't accept. If it's freeing a slave, Allah doesn't accept. If it's Hajj, Umrah, Allah doesn't accept. Yeah, none of these Allah accepts. But as a matter of fact, Allah records sins for them as they do these good deeds. What? Yeah, because you're giving sadaqah. You took from somebody, you give to somebody else. Sorry, Robin Hood. You're not going to make it. If you are taking from one person, and then you're saying, okay, I'm going to give some of it. Some people actually have this mentality. I was surprised when I heard this. I was like, really? This person really thinks this? Yeah. Someone was arguing with me back home once. It was a taxi driver or something. He was talking about how, yeah, there are thieves out there who they will steal people's money and they'll give a portion of it in the way of God so that it's all halal. I'm like, bro, that's not how it works. This person actually thought one of the jobs out there is being a thief. He was actually justifying. He's like, God has put these people's money and wealth in other people's money, and so they have to go and fetch it. I'm like, man, get me out of this car before I turn kafir. Who is this guy? But he was actually arguing for that. Sadaqah isn't going to be accepted. Why? Because the money doesn't belong to you. Hajj, Umrah, you're probably paying for Hajj and Umrah through the haram money that you have, and so on and so forth. Like, you see, there are some things, brothers and sisters, it's a sin that might be worth it. I hate to say it like that, right? But if I'm going to sin, at least I should sin in a way that it doesn't affect everything else. And this is affecting everything else. So let's be careful about this one. Or another one by our sixth imam. It says something along the same lines. If a person who has gotten money and received money through haram means goes for Hajj, when this person says, Labbaik, Allahumma labbaik. And you know, sometimes these problematic ones, they feel really spiritual when they go on these journeys. And they feel more spiritual than people who don't commit haram that much. This person, it says, when he goes and says, Labbaik, Allahumma labbaik, the answer to this person is, La labbaika wala sa'daik. No, we don't want your labbaik. We don't want your sa'daik. We're not interested in you. We don't like you. And this shows that it is not accepted from them. But if a person goes with halal money, yeah, then when they say labbaik, Allahumma labbaik, and sa'daik, and all of that, yes, the answer is labbaik wa sa'daik. So we got to be careful about this. Okay, so we have one more thing that we have to be careful about then, because it affects everything. And finally, if none of that helps, because you all are Shia, or we all are Shia, I don't want to sound like I'm not Shia. We are all Shia. Yeah, this last one should do the trick. It says that Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali salawatullah alayh said, if a person who through haram means consumes the wealth of or the money of someone else, another believer. So the verse of Quran said, La ta'kulu amwalakum baynakum bil batil. When it comes to your wealth amongst yourselves, if you are going to consume each other's wealth through transactions and gaining like and earning from each other, it should not be through batil means. So if someone does that though, Imam Ali, he says, this person is not and never is a lover of me, no matter how much they say they're a lover of me. Okay. So if Allah's upset, if that doesn't work, Imam Ali's upset, guys. This is probably going to work sometimes better for us. All right, having said all of that, a few stories I want to share with you about this. There's a person by the name of Karbalai Kazim, okay? This is a person, illiterate, unschooled, village person back maybe 70, 80 years ago-ish. This person who has no knowledge of anything whatsoever is just a normal person. Probably does, you know, farms and things like that, and all of a sudden gains the knowledge of the Quran. Now, this is a story that, this is a person that, you know, we know who he is. It's not something made up. Like, he was tested by the Ayatollah Burujerdis of his time and the others of his time. He could actually tell you, if you showed him Arabic, which part is Quran, which part of it is just normal Arabic. Because some people think all Arabic is Quran, right? We have a joke in Farsi. They say there were two guys fighting. Like, one was Iranian, the other one was Arab. So the Iranian's saying bad words to this one. The other one's like coming back at that person with Arabic bad words that he's saying to him. Yeah? And so the Iranian guy starts laughing. They're like, why are you laughing? He's cursing you out. He says, no, he's reading Quran to me. Some people think all Arabic is Quran. Yeah? Well, this person, no. Although he was illiterate, it's famous that they would put Quran in front of him. He would show you which one is Quran, which part is not Quran. They're like, well, how do you know? He says, because one has nur, duh, and the other one doesn't have nur. What? Yes. Wow. Okay. How'd you get this? It says, how the students had circled around him once, and they asked him, how'd you get this? He said, no, I mean, I didn't really do much. I just was careful that I don't put haram in my belly. Now, that doesn't mean that a person like me, you and I, if we Allah's not giving us special powers, that we probably have some haram in us. No. Allah gives to certain people whatever he wants. So we don't have to have such expectations now. Assalamu alaikum, brother. Do you know the Quran backwards, in and out, and you can tell the nur from it? No, I can't. Now, you probably eat haram food every day. That's not a conclusion we can draw, necessarily. But good things happen. Brothers and sisters, parentheses, forget about these things, by the way. These are not the goal in life. The goal is to secure akhirah, all right? These things, if they happen on the side, they happen, alhamdulillah. If not, who cares?
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Whatever I will be, I don't need to be what you need me to be, yeah. I thank God for what he's done for me. You give me so much light, and you make me feel invincible. Alhamdulillah.
Invincible.
Allah's love has no limits. Allah's love has no boundaries. For every raindrop that falls, for every ray of sunshine, for everything is under His control. You cannot see Allah, you cannot touch Allah, but you can feel Allah. He is there in every tear that falls, in every smile that shows. Allah is all around us. I am whatever I may be, but Allah has already planned my destiny.
Welcome back, dear Iran radio listeners. It's Sunday, and I'm ready to share even more programs that will fill your faith and broaden your horizons. Let's check out what's coming up next. Our next program is The Keys of Life, your ultimate guide to an Islamic lifestyle. This program is aimed to introduce the Islamic lifestyle based on the profound book Mafatihul Hayat, written by Ayatollah Javadi Amali, discover practical guidance for a purposeful life. Next, join us for Africa Today. This program takes a critical and comprehensive look at Africa's economy, politics, culture, and business, offering a valuable overview of the continent's current affairs. Next up, Q&A on Islamic Beliefs is here to answer your questions. Our experts will respond to your inquiries about knowing God, His attributes, prophecy, and core beliefs. These questions are sent to us from cyberspace and email, so keep them coming. Stay tuned for now. Following this, we'll have The Key of Life.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitan rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Wa sallallahu ala Muhammadin wa ali baytihi al-tayyibin al-tahirin. Brothers, sisters, listeners. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to the program Mafatihul Hayat, Keys of Life. I am your host, Abdullah Al-Musawi. The second trait and characteristics that a just leader needs to have is to be responsible. Responsibility. So, this person who takes on the role of becoming a leader, who takes the role of becoming a president, he has the responsibility of taking care of people. Therefore, if he is not responsible enough, then he should not be there. If he only cares about himself and his wealth and his comfort, then obviously he's in the wrong position. Responsibility is required. Me and you, when we talk about our families, as a husband or as a wife, we have responsibility towards our family. The husband is responsible, the wife is responsible. And as the kids grow up, they also become responsible. Could you imagine what would happen if the father decides to neglect his responsibilities? Or the mother decides to neglect her responsibilities. Obviously, you're going to have a breakdown in that system. Same thing applies when we talk about a government, a system, or an Islamic system. Someone has to be responsible. The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam says, "Ala kullukum ra'in wa kullukum mas'oolun an ra'iyyatah." Every one of you is a shepherd, and every shepherd is responsible for those who are under his care. فَالْأَمِيرُ عَلَى النَّاسِ رَاعٍ, the Prophet said. The leader that places himself a leader on top of people, he's a shepherd. وَهُ مَسْؤُولٌ عَنْ رَعِيَّتَهُ, and he is responsible for those who are under his care. Therefore, we have to understand that you and I, we have responsibilities towards other things in life. But once we are in